Lawrence College.
Yeah. Oh, it's, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've stayed. I arrived there in 75 thinking I was probably on my way back to the East Coast, where I'm from. Here it is 30 years later, and I'm still there. And I love it there. I mean, it was one of the great, it was a stroke of luck. It was one of the great things that happened to me. I mean, it changed my life, transformed my life, made me who I am now. And so I believe in it. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Good evening, and welcome to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. My name is Peter Berg, and I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I'm delighted that you can be with us tonight for a very special reader, Jack Driscoll, whom I have been trying to get to come to East Lansing now for some years. And every time we think that our schedules have matched, something comes up. I think a couple years ago you were in South America.
I wish. Yeah.
That's what I think I remember, but it was a Fulbright or something?
Not even that.
Not even that? Okay. Different person. But still, we've had a hard time getting him here, so we're delighted that he can be here tonight. And I want to tell you a little bit about Jack before we begin with the reading. Jack Driscoll is the author of 4 books of poems, a collection of short stories, and 4 novels. In addition, he is the recipient of numerous grants and awards, including the NEA Creative Writing Fellowship, the NEH Independent Study Grant, Pushcart and Best American Short Story Citations, the Penn Nelson Algren Fiction Award, the Associated Writing Program's Short Fiction Award, and 7 Penn Syndicated Project Short Fiction Awards. His stories have been frequently read over NPR's The Sound of Writing, and his work has appeared nationally in magazines, literary journals, and newspapers such as the Chicago Tribune, Kansas City Star, Civilization, Poetry, the Georgia Review, the Southern Review, and Plowshares. His novel, Lucky Man, Lucky Woman, received the 1998 Pushcart's Editor's Book Award, the Barnes & Noble Discovery of Great New Writers Award, and the 1999 Independent Book Publishers Award for Fiction. Stardog, his 3rd novel, appeared in 2000, and How Like an Angel, University of Michigan Press Sweetwater release, appeared in 2005. Many of these books are up here, and they're available for sale, and I'm sure Jack would like to sign them for you, too. Jack was born in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and graduated from Wyndham College. He received his Master of Fine Arts degree from University of Massachusetts Amherst. He currently lives in Interlochen, Michigan, where he is writer-in-residence at the Interlochen Center for the Arts. For tonight's program, Jack will read for about 45 or 50 minutes, and then afterwards he will welcome questions from you up here at the table. And as I said, if you wanted to buy a book or two, that would be wonderful too. So please join me in welcoming Jack Driscoll.
Thanks, Peter. Well, it's great to be back from my Fulbright in South America. It's a wonderful climate. I'm going to read just 2 sections from the new novel. It's called How Like an Angel, and I stole the title from a Thomas Traherne poem I've always loved that begins, "How like an angel came I down." So I just appropriated the first part of that. Nice form. It also appears in Shakespeare. I think it's in, am I right? Is it Hamlet? How like an angel? Pretty sure it is. Anyway, I'm gonna read the first chapter, which is the shortest chapter in the novel. And it's always harder reading from novels than it is reading poems or reading short stories, particularly when you get away from the first chapter, because so much depends on what has preceded, say, chapter 7. But this appeared first as an NPR piece. I hadn't thought at that time that this would become part of the novel, but it did. And I'm a fisherman. Chris Campbell can attest to this. There was a time in my life when I used to fish 200 days a year. That's long ago. And I was moody or something, and I was on my way to the Platte River steelhead fishing, and the weather was as odd as my mood. And I usually crank up Bob Dylan or somebody on the CD, and for whatever reason, I left the music off, and it was warm, and I cranked down the window, and it was foggy, and then I heard this strange sort of noise, and had no idea what it was, and it turned out to be a swan who flew over the cab of the pickup and then descended on the hood, or would have hit the hood if I hadn't hit the brakes, as it turns out, on ice, at which point I started going around in a series of 360s, and every time I came to the apex, I would see this swan in front of me somersaulting down the road in front of the pickup. And finally we came to a stop, everything came to a stop, and the bird was out there looking pretty beaten up. And I didn't really know what to do, except that my wife's pea coat was in the seat next to me, and so I got out of the car and put the swan in the pea coat and put the swan in the pickup and took her, though I'm not sure it was a she, and put her in the river behind the house. And it became one of those sort of deep space memories, those indelible memories, and it just stayed with me. And at some point I decided, well, maybe there's a story in this, and so this is the opening chapter. It's called Squalls. Archie Angel, by the way, is a 41-year-old fishing guide. And the novel is structurally more inventive than anything I've tried previously. And by that I mean we have one point of view character, but we have two points of view in the novel. The novel is told from the present ongoing story is told from the point of view of a 41-year-old guy, and it's also told in flashbacks from the point of view of a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy, Archie Angel. And so this is in the present. This is told from the adult point of view. It's called Squalls. "We're just plain bad for each other, Archie," Z says. Z is Archie's wife. Z is short for Zelda. Cutting characteristically straight to the point. "Still, she has consented to this drive. 1 hour, she says, tops. After all, what's left to say that can possibly take any longer than that? Probably nothing. Nonetheless, the caddy is full of petrol, the hour already fleeting, and, by her own reluctant admission, she concedes again to that unmistakable, deep-seated something we just can't resist about each other. I've owned this land yacht, a ruby red 1975 convertible, for longer than I've known Z. Power seats, an electric eye on the dashboard, and a trunk you could share with a small rhinoceros. A take charge coupe de ville that I lucked into with a ridiculously lowball estate sale bid. We're here on good tread, the snow slashing so hard into the headlights that we're momentarily blinded and staring dizzy-eyed into the tunnel between these fields of last year's standing corn. But this is not a storm we're cruising through. These are Michigan lake-effect squalls that slow us sometimes to a crawl. But once they open up, the road is slick black and entirely inviting. My arm around Z like old times, the world wildly alive again, and the radio loud. Archie, she says, turning the volume down a few decibels, we've been down this road how many times before and to what end? When I don't respond, she says, you do realize, don't you, how hopeless this is, how completely insane? I can tell she's softening, making this the most delicate moment of the drive so far. One wrong utterance and it's over, and this time, no doubt, for good. Nonetheless, I launch into this speech about real caring and trust over the long haul. I argue that on a sliding scale, maybe we've slid as far as we're going to into that marital dead zone all couples fear. And from now on, the momentum's thrust is up, up, and away. It's the kind of testimonial you can ever only deliver straight face to someone you honest to God love and actually mean it. Impassioned assertions that do not, however, as I've discovered firsthand, stand up well against the lessons of either logic or experience. Z's an artist, a master glassblower with a degree from RISD, and I remind her how often she's argued her theory that anything can be transformed by art and love, absolutely anything. This marriage, I ask, flipping the wipers off again as we finally exit another squall. But this one's different, dissolving so slowly at the thin, opalescent blue rim of first light that it feels mystic. And I get serious chills when a swan emerges from that same dense snow behind us, with its wings outspread not 3 feet above the wet and shiny hood. It's that close. And Z whispers, Archie, and I hit the brakes hard on black ice, as it turns out, and we're spinning now into a series of 360s, the top-heavy front end of the caddy hesitating just long enough at the apex of each wide swoop for us to glimpse the torture of that enormous white bird's interminable somersaulting on the pavement. We come to a stop in an empty field, the engine stalled. Z is holding my hand, squeezing it, and the radio is suddenly all static, like the snow. And Z is humming some made-up song, just staring out the tinted windshield and humming like she's been stunned. I can tell already that one of the swan's wings is broken, and one eye is completely shut, and the wind keeps lifting its neck feathers. I don't want to move a muscle, but the gasoline fumes are strong, and I'm afraid the car might blow, so I switch the ignition off. And maybe it's the tinkling of the keys on the key ring, I'm not sure, but Z lets go of my hand and leans forward and takes off her navy pea coat and says, here. She says, please, Archie, you've got to go help it. You've got to. What's most humane in this situation would be to put the swan out of its misery as quickly as possible and by whatever available means. But try explaining that to the woman you've loved and are losing and so desperately want back in your life. Look, there's an inch of ice on its wings, I say, though I'm not sure how that matters exactly, except perhaps to solve the mystery of this terrible accident we've just witnessed. Go get it, Archie, she pleads, and she starts to cry because the swan is staring back at us with its one good eye, from me to Z, back and forth like that. You don't just walk up on wounded things, I say, with absolute certainty, not on wild things, Z. Listen, I don't even have any gloves with me, which sounds like the chintziest and most insensitive and cowardly excuse in all God's creation. Listen to me, I say, but she doesn't. Instead, she lowers her face deeper into her hands, and I notice, really, for the first time when I touch her hair, the first hints of gray, and how, unlike me, she's not wearing her wedding band. Which frightens me so much that I get out of the car and breathe deeply into the cold air to try and clear my aching head. And it begins to snow again, enormous feathery flakes floating down slow motion and so thick that when I wrap Z's wool coat around the swan and pick it up against my chest, I know she can only imagine in what direction I've gone, where it is I've bolted to under pressure this time. The only reason I don't call out to her like someone lost and panicked is that this bird has actually leaned its face against mine and seems to be asleep. Even more so when I lay the swan in the back seat, collar up, those black anchor buttons fastened like a line of poker chips down the center of its breast. It would be comical if it weren't so damn sad. She says, "Archie, look," and I do. This time in the rearview mirror, and what I see is that orange bill opening and closing as though it were trying to speak. Because I can't get the car started, there is nothing we can do. The plumes of pink sulfur from the emergency flare I've already lit are visible on the road's shoulder. But nobody is driving this far outside of town on a Sunday morning. I imagine parishioners attending early mass and lighting candles at the feet of St. Francis, birds perched on his fingers in the Church of the Sacred Heart where Z and I were married in a tiny private ceremony. Z, now huddled under the Hudson Bay blanket I stash in case of winter breakdowns, asks, "Is it really true that swans mate for life?" I nod, close my eyes, and wonder if the other is up there circling and circling, and then I crack the window and listen for that unmistakable slow whistle of its wings. I hear nothing, and I realize that it's not in me right now to confront the loss that sound would mean. Z says she needs to say a couple of things which she worries might sound foolish, but I tell her no, that nothing could with such a beautiful creature dying so close to us. She has no idea how soothing the music of her voice is, no earthly idea. "We go way back, don't we, Archie?" she says, and I nod yes. Her head on my shoulder, her right arm draped over the seat back where I know her fingers are fluttering slow, final dances for the swan. Then Z asks me if I remember Swan Lake, which of course I do, the only ballet I ever attended. Yes, I say, every last detail, the tight black strapless satin dress she wore, and the way the camera shutter seemed to stop in mid-click, and that handful of white rose petals she threw towards me, laughing on those mammoth granite stairs outside the theater, and how she flapped her arms as though she might rise and fly, a raven, I thought back then, or a crow, or yes, a rare and elegant black swan. "Archie," she says again, "don't you wish sometimes that we could retrieve the best parts of our past, just those, and hold on to them forever?" I swear to her that we can, which I know is a lie. "No," she says, "it's over. This time it has to end, this time for good." I know that, I tell her, and although true or not true, I want to believe that nothing ever really dies. But Z is already reaching for the swan and crying again, as there must always be a first to cry out among the great flocks that take off by the thousands to migrate home. And then pair off, and because the world is sometimes like this, one must go on alone. So that opens up the novel and sort of creates a metaphor for the trouble, the turmoil in his marriage and other things. I'm going to jump 70 pages. Is this better? Does this sound good? Was there a lot of feedback in the... could you hear anything? Okay, I'm going to read that part again. No, just novels are novels. Lots of things happen. Archie's father is a mortician, which is why he's driving a hearse. His mother suffers from manic depression, and it manifests itself in a kind of dyslexia, meaning that she can recite Shakespeare sonnets backwards and does. But it's also where he makes a kind of contact with the world. His father is cold and afraid of affections and distant in many ways. This is called Loon Lake. It's chapter 7. And this is Archie speaking, I think, as an 11-year-old kid. I'm not only going to begin in the middle of the chapter, I'm going to begin in the middle of a sentence. Archie, who is 41, has a son who he sees only every other weekend, and then for longer stretches during the summer, and his name is Rodney. And I mention that because he comes up at the very end. We're slow drifting out into Loon Lake, out over the deep drop-off, the heavy wooden ribs of the rented rowboat settling into the water. Does that sound better? We've rented it from early summer right through Labor Day for a song, as my dad said. One small victory for the newcomers, the early risers. It's perfect because we leave the boat right here, unchained and unlocked in the tussocks and cattails, like this is our own remote and private lake. Pretty much it is, given that I've never seen another person about, never once, no matter what time of day. I've seen the loons, though. Two different pairs, plus their young, who have grown now, and already I can mimic those lonely, shrieking, off-key cries they make whenever we arrive. A stable and quiet craft, my dad calls it, as opposed to the noisy and less seaworthy aluminum kind that leaves no margin for human error. And because he is not a good swimmer, this makes all the difference. It's why he lets me stand smack dab in the boat's damp center, feet wide apart while I cast and cast my silver and blue Johnson spoons, retrieving them across the weed beds with a jerky, wounded minnow motion. And with each strike, I set the hook hard, the rod whipping taut above my head. I'm a natural, he says, entirely self-taught. And how can anyone learn that much about catching fish in only a few short months? They, by the way, have come to own this cabin because his father has traded a funeral in full for this cabin and 80 acres on the Platte River. Then he reminds me again that I both walked and talked at 11 months, always a step ahead of the curve, he says, always the adventurer. He does not possess that same magic feel or touch anywhere outside the mortuary, that all-important hand-eye coordination, nor the need to exceed simply tagging along, as he puts it, with the master angler. That's plenty, he says. It's a gift just to be out here in God's country relaxing like this, and he concentrates instead on the antiphonal lapping of water against the hull. The fresh early autumn air and the turning leaves, the sumac blood red along the shore, where a single sugar maple on the upslope explodes orange like a sun above the cattails. Unfortunately, he never lets on what he's really thinking. Sometimes we'll fish Loon Lake twice a day, early morning and evening, when it's by far the best. I can't get enough, though I wish my dad hadn't stopped bringing his camera after the first few trips. I mean, in most respects, it's all right. And granted, he gets plenty excited for me whenever a good-sized pike struggles to climb away from the water, to shake loose the thick treble knotted in its jaw. Still, it would be nice, after four straight months, to capture at least one of these father-son trips. A shot or two of me out here in the boat, smiling wide-eyed and holding up a keeper, both wrists straining, its silver sides shimmering against all those vibrant primary autumn colors slow-burning and reflecting in the background. I'd like to send one to my mom for her birthday. She has taken off in the middle of the night with the family Rambler and has been gone now for 3 years, just disappeared to Wisconsin. I'd like to frame and send one to my mom for her birthday. It falls this year on the first Sunday in Advent. That's me after another growth spurt, I'd say, on the reverse side. That's me as proud and happy as I've ever been, and date it, and maybe in that way entice her to visit, at least set the thought in motion, which I guess I haven't so far. Got one, I shout, fish on, and after maneuvering it close enough, my dad reaches over the gunwale and loops that long-handled net over the fish's head, another average-sized pike, and pulls it to the side of the boat where he clubs it with a miniature Detroit Tigers baseball bat. Womp, womp, without ever even wincing.
always twice between those flat, cold-blooded yellow eyes, the pupils falling away, not into the forehead like a person fainting, but down into the cheeks, disappearing like small moons. But what he's best at by far, after we get home, is slitting their luminous white bellies clean with his surgical scalpel, a line so fine and precise it's nearly invisible until he spreads it apart with his thumbs. Sometimes he'll slide out a whole undigested smelt or crawfish, and those are the nights I dream of monster pike and tiger muskies that swallow young ducks, jerking them under by their webbed feet, shaking them violently until they drown. Another thing I tried to do in the novel was to occasionally fuse the two voices, the adult voice and the young voice, and that sort of comes together in this short section here. Here's another saying, my mom quoting Milton. Tears such as angels weep burst forth. It's an evening excursion, and we've forgotten the club and the metal stringer and who knows what else. My dad's been doing that more and more as the weeks and months tick by, forgetting things, and I get the distinct impression his mind is elsewhere, that he's only here out of loyalty and habit now, his attention flagging more and more, which tends to half ruin the trips. At least I wish he'd talk to me, or smile, or wink, or something other than light up another cigarette and turn away. I suppose silent company is better than no company at all, but it does send a mixed message, doesn't it? I don't say that, of course, or even dwell on it all that much if the action's good and the fish that hits this time is enormous, powerful in a way I've never experienced before, except in my imagination. Even after fighting him for 20 minutes, I can still feel the weight of his tail fanning all the way down in the rod butt, the line cutting wildly back and forth through the water. I don't want to lose him, not this one, not so late in the season. Please, I whisper to myself, wishing I had re-knotted with heavier leader after landing that last fish. My arms ache each time he head shakes and lunges deeper. Please, I whisper again, and tighten the drag, the rod bent almost double, and this time I'm able to nose him slowly upward and toward the stern, where my dad makes the perfect scoop, a pro when the chips are down, when I most need him to come through for me. At this moment, I love and trust him almost enough to believe he's right when he says, don't worry, we'll make do, we'll manage just fine with what we've got. He says, holy Moses. He says, Jiminy Christmas, as he kneels prayer-like and reaches slowly into the blue braided nylon, attempting to lift this summer's trophy catch out by its gill plate, the insides pink as a tongue. No kidding, this fish must weigh a good 10 or 12 pounds, far and away the biggest I've ever seen, and I'm still speechless and shaking. Jeez, look at him, my dad says. Now there's one for the record books. Jeez, oh, Pete, he's a dandy. Good for you, Arch. Good for you, son. You sure got the magic touch out here, don't you? Holy Moses, he says again, never in my youth. I don't know where you get it from, but you sure as heck know what you're doing out on the water. Yeah, really works, I say, referring to the extra treble, the trailer that I wired to the lure, just like the guy at the bait and tackle shop showed me. He said, be careful though, which is exactly what my dad keeps mumbling to himself. Be careful. Be careful now. A weak-minded caution I've learned. Whenever a northern pike this size thrashes back to life, a wild and violent writhing single muscle girth of silver torpedo, and next thing I know, it happens that fast in a single blink, one hook has buried itself beyond the barb, deep into my dad's thumb, the second treble catching him in the palm of the other hand. It's as if the moment has stopped, and I can see myself much more frightened than disappointed, and so utterly helpless to even move, the fish fitting down and away, the net doing its slow-motion oval dance to the clear bottom of the lake. My dad does not scream or swear or utter any single thing. Instead, he sits carefully back on the green plastic seat cushion and stares into his hands as if they were mirrors, as if pulling them close to his face, he can see the rest of his life fading beyond his hairline. Dad, I finally say, and when he gazes up at me, he seems both old and very tired, as if he hasn't slept in days, as if maybe now, right here in the middle, in the watery middle of nowhere, he's going to choke up and then he's going to cry. He does neither. He waits silently for maybe a full minute, as if deep in thought, and then he says, "Bite the leader as close as you can to the lure." He's forgotten to put the pliers back in the tackle box, so I lower the rod and move toward his cupped hands, the backs of them held out to me like a man protecting his last match from the wind. It's blowing from the south end of the lake, the boat rocking, so I grab hold of both his wrists to keep from falling overboard. And then, sitting on his knees, facing him, I put the thin, almost invisible line between my teeth and watch the silver blue of the lure flash the last remaining light across my lips. "Okay, free," I say, and using only his elbows, he nods and pushes me away and sits down on the floor planks, shifting awkwardly between the wooden ribs and into the safe access of the boat's wet center. "Arch, get us back," he says, but I cannot pull both oars through the choppy water together. No matter how hard I try, my lips pressed closed with the effort. Too much dead weight to maneuver, so I slide across the seat from one oar to the other, back and forth, trying to straighten the heavy nose. But it's no use, the rowboat arcing around in a full circle farther out into the lake. In the waning light, at the level of the trees, two golden eyes descend smoothly into the reeds downwind and out of sight along the darkening shoreline. My dad, like a man in handcuffs, says, grimacing, "Move over, son." He's standing right behind me, blood down to his elbows like the blood that drips down the silver sides of stunned and dying fish. Before taking one oar, he lowers his hands a single time into the cold, spring-fed lake water and then twists his locked hands back and forth until the oar handle comes out gleaming red beyond his thumbs. "Row, Arch," he says, "for the love of God, row," and he begins his count, the rhythm steady as a pulse. It's just a kid's fear, I guess, but the lake suddenly seems to double and then double again in size, and I do not care anymore if I ever fish again, here or anywhere else. I only want for my dad to be all right and to not hold whatever this night becomes against me. "One," he says, again, "Arch, one, one," and I know if I try to count along with him, I'll burst into tears. And this is 2.5 pages in this chapter. Little break here. Who's Milton? What's paradise lost? What does he mean, the palpable obscure? I won't know for years, although I can hear so clearly my mom's lulling recitations as I pull for all my skinny, aching arms are worth. The lake widening and widening behind us the closer we get to shore. We're in perfect sync, and together we're going fairly straight, though my dad's already breathing hard and coughing a lot, and at one point he says, "Rest." He says, pointing up with both wounded hands, "Look, because there's Cygnus, the Northern Cross, though neither of us is well enough versed in the language of the constellations to even attempt to name or describe their animal shapes. All we can say is that they're so incredibly bright in the ocean of the sky tonight, bright enough to navigate by if we were ancient mariners, father and son, experienced helmsmen traveling home alone from distant lands. It doesn't really take us all that long, half an hour at most, and my dad says, I'm sorry, because stepping ashore at season's end so empty-handed is entirely his fault, and he hopes he hasn't wrecked everything with his clumsiness. Have I? Have I, Arch? No, don't say that, I tell him, which, if not an outright and transparent distortion, is at least open to interpretation. Here's mine. At 11 years old, I land a once-in-a-lifetime northern pike, but out of carelessness or oversight or chronic inattention to the essentials, we don't have a single glossy colored snapshot, nor any exact weight or measurements, nothing tangible enough to prove that there are, indeed, certain days unequaled on this earth, days and nights created to celebrate forever who we are together and why. This one's gone, vanquished, even the bragging rights. And in the painful retelling, it's a story not about the granddaddy pike that got away, but about how my dad snagged only himself, a sorry excuse for a memory, or rather, a memory run amok. And how he left the rod and tackle scattered in the bottom of the boat and two-stepped it single file up the dark path to the hearse, the blurry star patterns riffling across the hood. So, when he told me to, I reached without a word into his left front trouser pocket for the car keys and opened both doors and helped him slide behind the steering wheel. I reached across his body and turned on the headlights, then shifted for him into reverse, then into drive. What I remember most is how he steered with his forearms, his fingers interlaced as if he were praying his way up the old logging cut, the wave of the high beams slamming over every rut into the darkness of third growth pines. The needles gleamed, the air thick and lush with the scent of them. The scales on his hands appeared green in the dashboard lights, as he put it, a fish out of water. He said something about his dad and trade-offs and surviving disappointments, about there being other days, you'll see, but they were hard to imagine with this one having gone so wrong and not nearly far enough behind us yet. Radio, he said, and I turned it on just in time for Perry Como to serenade us with Catch a Falling Star, which I surmised even then was an ironic blessing from above. By that, I mean we didn't have to say a single other awkward thing. Instead, we sang along, or he did. I mostly hummed the melody, my head pressed against the seat back so I could maybe see the stars if they fell. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket, save it for a rainy day. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away. All the way to the emergency care in Frankfurt, I couldn't get that single tune out of my head. Not even as I sat alone in the waiting room, where I closed my eyes after a while and imagined my dad, mouth open and breathing quietly those exact same lyrics. Maybe that's why I still heard them playing over and over that bit about love and pocketing even one star. I know it sounds far-fetched, but when I squeezed hard, I swear I felt the silver-blue starlight knotted like a ball in my palms. Arch, my dad said, lightly shaking my shoulder, wake up. He said, look, and flexed his fingers and bandaged thumb, and because I hadn't yet drifted all the way back from sleep, his amateur sleight of hand wasn't half bad. Here it is. As he reached behind my ear for the lure, both big treble hooks gone, and when he dangled it by the barrel swivel under the bright white ceiling lights, it flashed and glittered. Still bleary-eyed, I flicked out an imaginary cast and started to reel, and on our slow ride home in the hearse, my dad conceded, yeah, it smarts a little all right, but that's fair, I guess. That's what I get for being sloppy. That's life. Then he described the worst part, the doctor's tug and pull, the tetanus shot, and I got kind of queasy and quiet all over again, but I didn't ask him to stop with the painful and grisly details. He said there were frozen fish cakes at home we could thaw out if I was still hungry. He said we'd sleep in tomorrow if that seemed all right. He said a lot of things until the oncoming headlights through the fog bank momentarily blinded him, and he turned his eyes away from the road just long enough for me to glimpse a face I'd never seen before. A scared, ghost-like face I'd remember clearly but wouldn't recognize until many years later when my own son stared at me in a certain way. And like my dad just did, I'd ask Rodney, what? In the affirmative, nothing, which is only what I said then. Staring straight ahead at the illuminated, slightly moonward slant of the road, followed by my dad's slow consenting nod, as if the true worth of our lives on earth could ever be acknowledged by such a simple and necessary lie. Nothing, I said again to myself, really nothing at all. So, anyway, there you go. That's Archangel. Okay. Thanks for coming out. I'll hang around for a few minutes, and then I'm going to hit the road back to Interlaken, which door-to-door is exactly 3 hours, so with any luck, I'll be home by midnight. Thanks again.